welcome back to Sales is King. This is Dan Sixsmith. I am your host, and welcome to another episode. We've got another great guest, Brian Coro, the SVP of Global Sales at Pendo. Brian, welcome to the show, my friend.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me, man. Really excited.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I've gotten to know you over the last, little while here, and really enjoying our relationship here, and excited to have you on the program. So, this is all about everything sales. You're certainly right in the thick of it in the B2B space, SaaS, great company. And love to just start with your story, kind of like, how did you get into sales and how did you wind up at Pendo? Let's hear it, man.
Yeah, man. Probably the most non-traditional path to sales and software that you could possibly travel. Actually started early in my career with the military, right? Come from kind of a long lineage of that. It was kind of an expectation, I would say. My grandfather retired, my dad served, and so that's all I wanted to be when I grew up. I didn't really even think about sales as a profession, but had the luxury of doing that for almost 9 years, right? And through some unfortunate situations, kind of figured out I couldn't play Army anymore overseas. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of had to make that transition. So I did what every self-respecting professional does in that transition, which is fucking went to grad school to try to figure it out. And, through that experience, I started working on an MBA and was introduced to a Vista Portfolio company here in North Carolina. And I have to say, like, coming from the military and kind of the how regimented that is for a profession, is falling into Vista was probably the best place I could have fallen, if I'm being honest. Like, these concepts of playbook selling and the Vista playbooks was introducing operational rigor to me on the business side, on the software side, that spoke very, very natural to me. And had the luxury with a company called Relias to really ride from $40 million in revenue to, you know, almost 300 before I kind of made the transition to Pendo. Kind of why Pendo, I did the PE ride for 5 years. And, you know, at that time, the capital markets were great. The valuations were flying. And so I felt like going the VC route and experiencing that at a very, at that $40 million mark was kind of the ride I wanted to do. So that brought me here to Pendo. And I've been here almost 5 years now and had the luxury to essentially do the same ride. We just crossed $200 million in Q4. Still not bored. Every day is an adventure. So as long as that's true, I'm going to keep going, you know?
Oh, man. So how many years now in the sales kind of arena?
Over 10. I would say leadership wise, 18. Mm-hmm. I've led people for 18 years, and then direct sales and software, it's been over 10.
That's fantastic. And so how have you seen it change, you know, in the last few years? We were talking a little bit about, you know, how the pandemic covered up a lot of sins, you know, and free-flowing money in the tech world. But what are some of the changes you've seen of late?
Yeah, I mean, I think you had Doug May, I think, for your last episode that talked about right. this value selling concept. And I will say that value selling is 100% back. I think, you know, in the cheaper capital markets world, you really didn't have to be that good. The EBs were really pushed down one level, sometimes two levels of what we're seeing in the market today. More importantly, I kind of made that delineation between like the PE business approach and the VC business approach. The reality is I think they're converging. And you're starting to hear, you know, keywords like profitability, rule of 40, what's the EBITDA of a company? And all of it is kind of coming back to really, I would say, smart business. You and I joked about it. I think, you know, whether you're old enough for like the Miller Hyman blue sheets or Medic, or regardless of the framework that you use, everybody let that shit kind of collect dust for 5, 6, 7 years, and we're just getting after it and scrappy. And all of a sudden, what you're seeing is like the dusting off of these things and this idea that if you can't tie to pain, you don't have a deal, right? It's not going to pass muster to the CFO level of the business. And so I think it's healthy for us as professionals. And I think it's definitely been a challenge, because I think what we forget, right, is that a lot of frontline leaders who are 5, 6, 7 years into their career, the heyday of sales is all that they've known, right? They don't know the adversity of sales. And so I think how we bring our frontline leaders has been an interesting change that we've all just kind of had to get through.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I go back 300 years or so in the sales game, and you know, when Doug was, I wanted to mention this on the Doug episode, but you know, he talked about buyers having all resources and information. So back in the day, I was in the textile industry, and we sold fabric into the apparel manufacturers. And the only way to get in touch with these guys was by the old regular phone, but they never picked up their phone. So what did we do? We waited outside their buildings for when they came down for lunch. And then we would basically grab them and walk to the restaurant with them and try and get some business done, you know? So, you know, that's going back a ways, but you know, the reality is, you've got to evolve. And I guess the question is, like, why aren't more sellers readily adopting this kind of value selling and pain finding approach? Is it just because it's, you know, more comfortable to just talk about what we know and what we do, or what do you think?
I mean, I guess I go back to the leadership comment that I made, which is, I think, yeah. I mean, I kind of made a facetious statement to say frontline leaders, but the reality is, unless you have an establishment date in your career that goes back, not 300 years, but probably 08 to 2010, this is a very, very new motion for them. And, mm-hmm. you know, we certainly at Pendo have even second line leaders that are very close to have starting their career where that's all they've known. So I think, is it, I don't want to say a lack of reading, but I think it's just, and you're not willing to accept, or you think that the situation is temporary, that leads to this perspective that, you know, you're just going to weather the storm and protect your cash flow. And then that's going to lead to getting back to, maybe it's like people not wanting to buy houses because of the interest rate, as if it's going to go sub 3% again in the next 3 or 4 years. I think the reality is, this is the new normal. And I think we need to embrace this idea that, if you can't tie to a key initiative within an organization, you do not have a deal. And I think the reality is that we've got to find a way to unpack what that is. And I often tell my reps, I say, you know, look, the secret to winning more is losing faster, right? And when you get into these qualification calls, when you get into these discovery calls, you're unpacking what's most important for an organization. If you can't solve, if you can't tie directly your product to that reality, you need to move on, because the opportunity cost of that is just going to, you're just going to continue to run at something that goes nowhere.
Yeah, it's so true. And then, you know, the other thing is identifying all the different stakeholders. There's so many different, one thing I forgot to turn off, Brian, was my phone, but, you know, trying to find the, well, get all the stakeholders and then get consensus, right? So, you found a pain, you think it's kind of the, you know, maybe it's one of their top initiatives, but now how do you get all of the buying committee aligned? You know,
that's right.
What do you think about that? I mean, that's, how do you help the sellers, you know, identify everybody and then build consensus and almost become part of that buying committee, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of different ways to unpack that. I think, you know, first and foremost, I think what we're starting to see is a lot more of you could use the advantage in terms of like operational priorities. Certain companies are bringing back OKRs, but I think you're starting to see centralized priorities come back, even at the C level and the exec levels of businesses. They're agreeing on what are the most important things. I will say at Pendo, like some of the scrappiness that we're trying to bring is, we actually didn't write annual OKRs. We wrote them by the quarter. What are the most important things from an operational perspective now? And then every quarter, we're going to reevaluate them. Now, the reality is, what we will see is that there will probably be two OKRs that travel with us through most of FY25. But we wanted to really leave ourselves the ability to be nimble. So I think as a seller, you know, when you're talking with executives, and obviously getting to power and multi-threading is all kind of we're trying to work our way up in this org, is you're ultimately trying to understand what are those key initiatives. I think we're seeing less departmental OKRs. I mean, you may see it, it's fairly tactical, but tactical OKRs usually aren't going to lead to people buying stuff. And so for us, it's, you know, the greatest thing about Pendo, I think, is that it's a 1,000-pound army knife. And the bad thing about Pendo is it's a 1,000-pound army knife. And so you know, essentially we have use cases that tie directly to product. We have use cases that tie to CS organizations. We have use cases that tie to marketing. And so for us, it's like trying to multi-thread and really hook to where we can get to value the fastest. And then, you know, obviously try through an expansion motion to be able to continue to bring new value. But I think unpacking that has got to be the secret of your sales reps. And look, I think you may not get it on one go. I would love to think that every time I meet with an executive that's a potential prospect or even a customer that I'm going to walk them to the water that is why Pendo is so great. The reality is I think we have to be patient too. And right. we realize that the nurturing and really the buy-in is also kind of extended reality in this new world. And I think we just got to, you know, exercise some tactical patience, as we would say in the Army. And I think we're being forced to realize that, I think, in this new world.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, I think I know myself. I mean, I'm just competitive by nature. So I think every conversation I have to figure out that it's going to be a deal, you know, and if it's not, I'm disappointed, which works well in some cases, but in others, it's incredibly frustrating. But hey, well, you know, it's okay.
We actually, this would seem crazy. We wrote, like, actually, I'll give credit to one of the VPs here, Jeff DeReuter, wrote this. He runs our enterprise North America sales. And he wrote this, what is an op framework, that was like, have you established a pain? Have they verbalized, you know, the willingness to solve pain? Have they demonstrated the willingness to introduce at least three additional stakeholders within the organization and decision making? And if they don't meet these three criteria, it's not an op. Like, it doesn't enter pipeline. Yeah. And I think it's funny that you see this like level of rigor being built around what can even go from like a zero stage op to a one. But I think it's just what happens is, and you know, is you start moving everything into pipeline. You don't have enough coverage. So you burn a lot of calories chasing deals that aren't real versus actually burning calories to continue to create deals that are real. And then you end up with, you know, rep attainment that's in the toilet bowl and you're wondering why, how did we get here? And so you almost have to kill it at the top of the funnel or it just exacerbates the time of all your reps in the organization. And I think we've really gotten that back to basics, I guess is maybe the way I would frame it.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. You know, one of the things that a lot of the teams that we talk to struggle with is this, you know, compelling event, you know, and getting the why now kind of thing. You know, it's, you know, we can solve some of their challenges, but right now they're telling us we're kind of a nice to have. And, you know, what do you teach your reps, or, you know, what are some of the things you guys try and do to drive urgency? Because that's one of the biggest frustrations. It's like, yeah, you know, and then we're, you know, we're being asked like, what's the compelling event? And it's like, I don't think I have one. What we do sometimes in the value selling space is we talk about the cost of the status quo, you know, so we try and show them that, you know, what you're doing today is actually costing you a ton of money. That's why you should consider making this change. And there's a lot of risk in actually doing what you're doing today, but I'd love your take on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it really goes back to like, what problem are we solving? Right. And if the problem we're solving is not big enough that they're willing to move fast, then you're probably getting left out. Right. Like Pendo. And I, again, I kind of alluded to the kind of the three key use cases, or I would say ICPs, product marketing, and CS, like the message that resonates in those are still pretty standard, right? I think on the CS side, everybody in SaaS right now is being told to do more with less, right? It's like that old mantra that we love to just get beat over the head with. And, you know, the reality is that's very hard to do, like just getting more blood from the rock. So what they look to do is find solutions that will allow them to do that at scale, and obviously positively impact exactly what they're trying to accomplish. So CS, what are those things if you unpack it, right? They want to be able to do ticket deflections that, you know, will decrease the amount of human effort required to be able to address their customers' needs in real time. They want to be able to onboard users from a, you know, in an automated fashion that, you know, burns less calories. And so, you know, these are things that everybody is trying to solve right now. And as a rep, you're creating a compelling event of that pain relief in the CS organization. If you look at product, like, you know, the digital evolution is just speeding up, right? I mean, I think the one of the things that really excited me about coming here is that I felt like Pendo would be to product what like Marketo and Braze were to, really the Markops world. And so, as we think about that digital and how people are interacting with your software, if you don't have a way to track features that they're using, features they're not using, what's the sentiment and the value that you're actually delivering in app? Like, that's very costly. So back to your question is like, how do you create that compelling event? Is if you can't tie to a true business impact pain that they are immediately trying to solve, I think you're going to continue to just see that close date kick out, kick out, kick out. Yeah. And if they're a savvy rep, they'll close, loss it, and then reopen it 60 days from now as if to not like have bad pipeline hygiene. But it just eats you up, right?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you're right. So let's talk a little bit about, building pipeline, getting to prospects, prospecting, as we call it, and then the interaction of marketing. So a lot of companies I talk to are frustrated with their marketing departments, which I think has been going on for forever. Sellers always want more leads. They're not getting enough leads. And then they have to rely on their own prospecting skills. I know you guys set aside an entire day of the week to do prospecting, but talk to me a little bit about what's working in trying to break through and get meetings.
Yeah, I mean, if you look, we were very blessed through the pandemic that we were vertically agnostic enough that yes, we did have customers and potential prospect verticals that were not ideal. If you think about like restaurant, any kind of service industries, like obviously struggling, things like ed tech were really booming. So I would say we really got through COVID pretty strong. Like our inbound demand was still very strong through COVID, and 60, 65% of our converted deals roughly were coming through inbound. And so you had BDRs at a really good ratio doing all your outbound prospecting. You were seeing the IDR volume that was leading to reps hitting quota. So everything was great, right? Like we didn't get, obviously not great. If I had to wear another mask, I'd lose my mind, but like we got through it. And then you fast forward, right? And then all of a sudden, we kind of had this capital slowdown. You saw the Series A slow down, the Series B slow down. Capital became more expensive. Software became like the industry as a whole started just really holding on to every dollar, trying to figure out what this meant for themselves. And in that world, what we saw was our digital demand, our digital marketing program was yielding, kept going down and going down and going down and going down. And then what we realized was one, we're burning a lot of dollars in a digital demand program that's not generating dollars. And we don't have an outbound culture as a business. And so like what we had to very quickly do is kind of shift the mindset of sellers, right, within Pendo and really bring this outbound prospecting culture that went beyond just a BDR. Like, Mr. AE, sir, like your job now is going to be about outbound prospecting and driving it. And then what we saw was, a shit ton of activity, not a lot of pipeline coming in pretty regularly. So great. Now we've got this built in as a muscle, but it's not generating anything. Why is that? And then you realize that what we're doing is throwing a bunch of stuff in an outreach sequence and hoping that something will come back, right? And then you realize that our EBs are all consolidating to a CFO. So you, regardless of what software company you are, you're emailing, you're LinkedIn, you're sending messages, and we're all speaking to the same damn people trying to get them to, trying to tell them why we're important and why you need to consider us. And so, what we did was actually have to rethink, okay, we've got the activity. We're starting to build a culture. Now, how do we think about it differently? So, obviously you can talk high level, like reframing messaging and talk about business value, blah, blah, blah. I think at the end of the day, what we wanted to hyper-focus is like, how do we build a really strong account scoring prioritization model that we can actually take our BDRs and our AEs and have them focus across the entire territory, but have them focus in a very different way. So like, if you think about tier one accounts, which would be like obviously our highest propensity to buy accounts, they're software companies within a certain size. In those accounts, like those are the ones we want the AEs really burning calories on, right? Like that's where we want them reaching out, putting them in nurture, really trying to work to get multi-threaded and get introductions through the org. And then we have our BDRs run more of our programmatic stuff. Now, I am happy to report post-COVID, the other part of marketing from a pipeline perspective that we saw that nobody talked about was like the power of event based on field-based marketing. Like, you know, those programs, we took all the money out of it during COVID, obviously. That's and then we just hoping digital demand programs would drive pipeline. So I think like what our marketing team, you know, does really well here. And I know Joe and Betty Mock, I mean, I think the things that they've done well is thinking about the program very holistic, right? How do we, as an international company, how are we focused on brand depending on the maturity of our markets across the world? You know, what does our field marketing program look like? How do we ensure to drive attendance? These have been hugely impactful and honestly, not in just enterprise. I mean, I was in an event last week, week before last in DC. And I mean, we had a ton of, you know, 500, 600 person companies that are willing to come and hang out and learn about Pendo. I mean, I still believe we are very much in that value creation space. And then digital spend and how does that digital program? But I think you have to think of it like three legs of a stool. And you honestly, it's got to start with like brutal ownership. You know, I think that's a big thing, regardless of what military book you ever read. Like the rep has to believe that they are responsible for their own fucking pipeline and nobody's coming to save them, right? There is no life raft coming. If our conversion rates, our win rate, you know, if we're batting right, one out of three and you don't have 3x coverage, you're in trouble. Right. And I think we've kind of brought that beyond some kind of dedication to duty on a Tuesday. But I think that's been the evolution from an inbound culture kind of pre this capital situation that we saw to the reality of today, which is not a lot of people just going to throw a credit card in there for 20 grand. Right. So you're going to have to get after it and get a little scrappy.
Yeah. I mean, you said so many great things there, but it's like it's the culture, it's the mindset, and it's. And I've been saying this for a long, long time, like you do have to be responsible for your own, you know, existence. You can't, it would be great, you know, if the leads just keep flowing in, but you've got to go out there and get it done. And you've got to assume there is no marketing department, you know, so changing that mindset and the culture, I think is really, and I think a lot of companies are wrestling with it. So I think that's super important. The second thing is the, you know, the in-person, which I think is so important. It was interesting. I listened to an interview with one CMO and they were calling it phygital, the physical and digital combination together and the power of, you know, in-person and then leveraging, you know, digital channels as well. And it's like all channels. So that leads me to like, if sellers are going to be better prospectors, what's your thought on the personal brand for sellers? Should they be active with a personal brand on the social channels? Because I think, you know, to me, it just seems like it's a must, because the first place anybody's going to look is going to be on LinkedIn. You know, if someone's reaching out and they seem pseudo interesting and, you know, do they have an active social profile? Are they creating content? Or they're like tumbleweeds going through and it's like, you know, it's the old school LinkedIn resume, profile. What do you think about the personal brand?
It's funny you say that because this is an area of focus for me this year. This is not an area I would say that I did exceptionally well. For my own self, right? So like I've started to post things and it's sometimes it's sales related, sometimes it's leadership related. But I mean, first of all, I would say that I think it's incredibly important in this day and age. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, great sellers have always had the ability to establish credibility and trust with their audience, right? And I think, so building that brand to your target audience is something like as an individual seller, you have to do it at a very, very high level. You know, people want to know, does this person understand like my business and the problems that I face? Or, you know, who have they helped in my space or companies that look like me? What have they done to positively impact the business outcomes? And so, you know, I think it's incredibly important to continue to share ideas. You know, what's funny is even sharing in these platforms, sometimes people fundamentally disagree with you. And I think that is so much more impactful than just nodding your head and be like, oh, that, you know, what he said was so great. Like, I love in these social platforms when people just completely disagree with you. I think anybody who works for me at Pendo would probably say Brian is going to say what he's thinking and that can be dangerous. But like, You know, I love the, I don't want to say combative. I like the fact that it's back and forth, because I think at the end of the day, we all get better. And if you have the ability, first of all, you're probably not an executive or a senior leader if you don't have the ability to self-reflect in a very, very critical way.
Right.
So when you get these, you know, opposing views and the ability to actually take a look at it and read through it, like, you actually are probably going to end up better than where you ever thought you were from a viewpoint perspective. So I think that's another part of the social part, even though I think naturally we tend to be non-conflict oriented. I like that part of it, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I love that. You know, I'm reminded of, this goes back a ways, but when I was a little more active on Twitter, I was posting my podcast links on Twitter, and, you know, sales is king, right? And then somebody wrote, you know, sales is not king. The customer is king, you know? And so I was like, whoa, you know, who is this guy? So turns out whatever, but I invited him on the show. And I think he was a kind of a senior guy at one of the marketing automation companies. And I just said, you know, I looked at his profile and I'm like, yeah, let's bring him on. And we did like kind of a, you know, point counterpoint a little bit. I got to dig up that episode, but that was fun. But I agree with you. You know, it's okay. Let's engage however we're going to engage, and you know, we're not all going to be, you know, on the same page. So, but that's fun. Right. Yeah, I think we agree on personal brand, for sure. So let's talk about the sales talent pool. How do you like? What's your process for hiring reps these days? What are your, you know, what are your top kind of criteria? Just curious. And what's the market like? Is it still a buyer's or seller's market, or what's going on?
I don't know. My personal opinion right now is that the sales talent market is a lot like college football in this transfer portal. You know, I think the reality is if you take a college recruiter in this world, they prioritize in three buckets, 1 to 3, right? Number one, what are they trying to do? They're trying to protect the talent that plays for them right now. And how do they make sure that they stay here at Alabama or Auburn or UNC next year? How do we make sure they don't go get an NIL deal at Colorado for $1.5 million more next year? And so, number one, you got to protect the talent that you have. Okay. College recruiters, number two is, all right, how do I look across this portal right now and look for highly skilled, experienced players that I can bring to my program right now? Maybe they're available in the market due to RIFs, maybe they're not. But like at the end of the day, how can I bring them in, inject them into my culture and get a boost in productivity, a boost in obviously growth rate? And then lastly, and the unfortunate reality of it is that person, that high school kid, and look, my son falls into this category as an athlete, is like, they're kind of the last priority. They're a work in progress. We hope that they will stay motivated and continue to drive, but the likelihood of that, we're prioritizing talent in the market that way, right? And so, and I think that's just an interesting way to think about like your talent within your organization in this current world. You know, where do we find top talent? Look, I think obviously we want to find a high, you know, a tech profile. You know, I want to understand who is their buyer. My secret is I love highly competitive markets. I love sellers that have been in sales tech. I love sellers that have been in CX tech, because I know there are a lot of players in the market that you're competing against. So if you're an achiever, you've been to club multiple times and you're in a crowded space, you know how to win, right? And I know that you know how to compete. I think that's really important. I think the evaluation piece for me beyond that, I'll always assess character. I think that's huge.
Yeah.
You, as much as you want to make people smarter, we can't. So like I always assess intelligence and where I think that that's at, and then ultimately experience. But I think top talent right now it's very interesting because larger companies have had rifts and had cuts in their business where they've used last in, first out as a methodology. So there is a lot of talent that's, you're not only trying to pull from, you know, companies because they're employed today, but there's actually some really good talent that's out there that is actually looking for that next adventure. And then maybe I close that question to say, A players know A players. So like leverage the networks of your players, as we've kind of added. And I mean, look, we've added close to 25, 30 enterprise reps over the last 6 months. Like we are leveraging networks hard, and we've brought in some really great leaders from Snowflake, MongoDB, like it's been really leveraging that as a way to pull in some A players. And, you know, my concept with my team on talent, right, as I said, you know, you need to treat your team like you manage the Yankees. And what I mean by that is everybody that plays for the Yankees is probably one of the best baseball players in the world. But if they could get a better first baseman next week, they would. Right. And so, like, how do you continue to think about your talent and leveling up your roster? Because essentially, at the end of the day, you're going to be judged by the output. And so, you know, so many thoughts on talent, but that's probably the way that I would round it out.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, I love the whole competition thing for sure, you know, because you just need folks that are competitive. So I'm going back to my textile days, but, you know, so we, so I was there for a long time, and the first half of my tenure was, you know, the salad days, and it was great. And then the second half, everything started to go overseas, and companies started disappearing, and our customers were doing full packages. So I call it the selling like your life depends on it.
I love
because
that.
That's exactly what it was, man. It was cutthroat, and it was survival. And companies were going out of business, and it taught me a lot, and I never forgot it. And I always, after I moved into kind of the marketing agency world, after that whole industry almost vanished, I never forgot it. And I always, to this day, always remember, sell like your life depends on it, because it just might, you know? So I love that whole competitive thing, and it resonates with me.
I grew up in a textile town, so I remember when everything shut down and left town. So that resonates with me really well.
It was pretty scary. So the timing for me was great. I had just bought a house in Westport, Connecticut, and my two young kids. Within, you know, the first few months, it was over. So I had to find a new career. So that's a show for another story. The art of the pivot and networking and keeping yourself moving. But let's talk a little bit about AI. We've had some folks on with wildly different opinions on AI. We had Dr. Lisa Palmer, who actually went out and got a PhD in AI, and she's advising companies today with just writing a blog. That's her demand gen vehicle. She writes a blog, and then Microsoft calls her up and says, you know, here's $1 million, come in and consult with us. But anyway, so she's a big believer, and she believes that if you're not actively embracing AI, if you're waiting on the sidelines, you're in trouble. Then I've had other sales influences in here saying it's too bloody early, and it's just causing more kind of garbage at scale. What's your thoughts on it? How are you leveraging it? And is it too early?
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly early. It's interesting because I almost look at this as like that next kind of evolution of tech. And, you know, I think about people that were like, the cloud is just a phase. Like, everybody's going to stay on-prem, don't move to the cloud. And people who did move to the cloud, obviously, now everybody is, right? But, or almost everybody, as long as it's not like sensitive
systems.
It's
a multi-gazillion dollar phase, yeah.
But the reality is it is still early, but it is still 100% kind of the path of the future. I mean, we've done a number of prospecting programs and pilots to kind of understand, because, you know, part of outbound beyond the activity and ensuring that we're executing is the personalization of the response. And AI is a way to be able to do that at a very scalable way, very quickly. The problem is we learned, and actually the problem with AI right now is the availability of data. Right? Like, do we have enough data that what gets pulled? And so people were lobbing emails, and then what was in it was 80% right, 70% right. So then it became like a proofread exercise. So, you know, we've definitely played with it. I think we have an opportunity from how sales uses it to certainly kind of ramp that up. But look, I mean, Pendo as a data analytics company for product, you know, we have like a retro analytics capability that captures everything, whether you tag it to be captured or not, we capture everything. And so Pendo is actually really leaning into the AI space as a product offering, because we have probably the most robust product data suite in terms of total data in the world, right? And so AI will certainly become a part of our product. And I think, look, I think users and tech don't want to be sent data that they then spend the next week trying to cipher through and unpack, and what's this telling me and how should we prioritize? So I think AI's ability to process data and not only digest it all, but also spit out, you know, these are the top three things that you should be focused on in the next 6 months from an organizational perspective. And to do that, you know, almost instantly, like that is truly the power I think that AI will have. It'll actually become, and good Lord, I grew up, my kids laugh at me when I say I'm pre-iPhone. Like they almost think that I'm a dinosaur. But, you know, the reality is I think we're exponentially moving so much faster, and AI is really going to be that next evolution. But programmatically, I think we could be better. And then you have regional differences, right? Like, you know, GDPR in Europe looks at AI very, very differently than the US. So like, I don't know, hypothesis wise, I almost think the US is going to go fast and Europe is going to go slow. And then at some point we're going to end up in the middle, and that'll be kind of the new normal in terms of how the world accepts AI. But it's an interesting time to be alive, I'd have to say.
It sure is. And you know, what's great also for us in the tech world is that companies are just investing, you know, they're in investment mode now because of AI. So, you know, hey, let's hitch your wagon onto that. But I think there's going to be hopefully a new wave of, you know, gazillions of dollars now that companies are, they're in the spending mode, which is good, you know? So I think that's really exciting. Well, good. This is really, really good. So, you know, we always like to get to know the guest a little bit, you know, outside of the workplace. So let's talk about you a little bit personally. And when you look back at your career or, you know, your life, who's been kind of the most influential and why?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would definitely give the credit to, I would say my grandfather, Ken Jodewin. He's sitting out there somewhere in DC right now looking at something, but, you know, retired as a full bird colonel from the Army, actually wrote part of the defense policy for South Korea back in, you know, the early 90s. Amazing. But like, he was always that guy that I really aspired to be, why I wanted to really join the military and become an Army officer. Like, he really kind of set the stage, I would say, for my life. He also just, you know, maintained a very high standard and pushed me really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for me, he's always been kind of that guy. And, you know, I, to this day, you know, we talk, and when we talk, it's like 2 hours. I have to look, and like, I, you know, especially in a global role, I'm like, look, I got to get off because I have this meeting in Australia at 9 p.m. EST, but, you know, love you. But I mean, he just kind of set the stage for that. And I think I owe a lot to where I'm at now, to where I started. And so that's where I would give him the credit.
That's great. How great is that, that you can still have him in your life and still talk about stuff, you know?
He's moving a lot slower these days, but he's there.
Hey, you know, but the mind is there.
That's right.
Which is great. You know, like my dad, you know, I still talk to my dad all the time. And I'm amazed at how he remembers so much of the details, you know, like when I'll talk to him, he's like, yeah, did that deal ever come in? You know, the one you were telling me where you were, you know, struggling a little bit with the whatever, you know, and I'm like, he's into it and he cares. And that, you know, that really means a lot. How about kind of mentors and, you know, as you were coming up in the sales world, anybody there that you can kind of point back to that kind of helped you along the way?
Oh man, it's a really long, I don't think any successful person really truly gets there alone. So like, I would say it's been a very long list for me professionally. Like I look at the way that I lead people and the way that I grew a passion to lead really started in the military. So like, I could give credit to Brad Gaddy and Brigadier General Charles Mazarak. Like these guys showed me what extreme ownership was. I think, you know, when you look, I think it's very natural sometimes early in your career as leaders that you look down in your org and you're like, you know, you're asked, why aren't you hitting your number? And you're like, well, it's that person, or it's that person. We have a bad tendency to look point down, whereas the military teaches the concept of extreme ownership, right? And so it starts and ends with you. You are the leader. You are responsible. What are you doing to fix it? And so those two guys, you know, across deployments and things like that really instilled that in me early. So I appreciate them. On the business side, you know, Jim Triandaflo, who was the CEO at Reliant, later he was the CEO at Insight Software. He's here in Raleigh, really taught like from a business perspective, how to have very high standards from KPIs and operating metrics. And so really, you know, mm-hmm. give him a lot of love. Bill Bench, who was the CRO here at Pendo when I got here, he actually brought me to Pendo. His dad was a Marine. You know, I don't hold that against him as an Army guy, but, you know, he, you know, was great. Obviously, his stints at Marketo and Pendo really brought me and like what it is to lead. Todd Olson here at Pendo, you know, I spent 9 months as the interim CRO here at Pendo and reporting to Todd and being a part of the C-suite. And, you know, he's certainly a visionary leader, but he, you know, he drives you, he pushes you. He want, you know, he'll always, you can give 100, he thinks you can get 110. And I always love that about him because it forces you to overthink. And then, you know, Miles Klager at Braze, I've had the opportunity to meet him twice. He's been great in terms of, you know, asking him questions and just unpacking his, he's a busy guy these days, but if we run into each other, I love to ask him questions. And then Brett Queener, who sits on our board, who's probably the toughest son of a bitch I've met in terms of his ability to just give you the brutal, honest truth as, you know, he sees it. But an early exec at Salesforce, he's at Bonfire Ventures now, but so many senior leaders that have either given me their ear or given me an opportunity to ask questions or sometimes when needed, just kick me in the ass. Right. And so, you know, I thank all of these guys kind of along the way, but it's been a fun journey.
That's great. I mean, that's a big, long list of people and impressive too. You know, I remember, you know, when I was, because I was just, as you were speaking, I was thinking of one sales manager I had back in the textile days. And I remember one thing that he told me. We were waiting in the lobby for the customer to come out, the buyer. And I was sitting down, you know, and he's like, no, he goes, you don't sit down. He goes, you don't sit down in the lobby because when they come out, then you have to get yourself up. You have to grab your bag. You have to fix yourself. No, you're standing. You know, we're standing, our jackets are buttoned, our bag is with us, and we're ready to greet the buyer. And I never forgot that. And I, from this day, I never sit in the waiting rooms. You know, I'm always standing and I'm ready to go.
You're that guy. So,
yeah, man. You know, so that was a good one. Charlie O'Donohue, and I didn't even really like him at the time, you know, but that was a good one for me. And I always make sure I'm standing. And when I'm with a group, they're like, "Sit. Why are you standing for?" I'm like, "You got to be ready, man. You got to be ready to go and shake their hand, not fumbling with your bag and you know your drink and putting your stuff together. You're there and standing upright." So, anyway, I wanted to throw that one in.
I love that.
So, how about outside the workplace? What are some of your fun things to do and hobbies? I know you're obviously with your son and sports and all, but what takes up most of your time outside the workplace?
Yeah. I mean, I would probably bucket. Well, I have two athletes in my house, 15 and 13. My son plays football and baseball and it has been blessed to be invited to events all over the country. So from, you know, Texas to California, we are very busy with these types of travels and events. I also coached for 12 years from the time he was really little.
Yeah, great.
I think now as he enters high school, he's excited I'm not coaching anymore because I used to always be that dad that was like, look, I'm not going to have a parent telling me that I'm playing daddy ball. So you better be like twice as good as this kid or you're going to be sitting over there. And so he's probably glad that I'm moving away from that stage of his life.
Oh, my God.
My daughter does competitive cheer. Actually, they've got an event down in Orlando. So I will say the kids outside of a 50, 60, 65 hour work week, that the logistics of all that probably eats up most of my personal time and my wallet. I actually have a shirt for my daughter that says, cheer dad, all I flip is my wallet because that's how I feel when we do these types of events. But, you know, it's, I would say that's huge, but I love to coach. You know, I joke about the textile side of this thing. Like, obviously, in small town USA, when all the textile mills closed, like I grew up in an area that was really drastically impacted by that. And so not a lot of figures in the community. And so like it was really important to me to be able to give back. And so I was very passionate about coaching for a very long time. I've so many kids that I enjoy over the year and they still come up to you at the grocery store. Hey coach. And now they look like grown men and you're trying to figure out who the hell that
crazy,
is.
Isn't it?
It's great. Yeah. Though. I loved it.
But it's a great feeling, you know, And it's amazing because at the time, you didn't really know if you got through to them at all, you know, because they were so young at the time. And then you see them as kind of a young adult, and they're like so appreciative and so thankful. And it's a great, you know, it's a great feeling. And I agree with you. So one of my buddies and me, we always used to talk to each other's kids after the game, because my son and you never listen to the dad. It's like white noise, you know? So he'd say, you take Mike and I'll take DJ, and we'll talk to them about, you know, how they did and what they can do better. Because he'll listen to you, Dan, and your son will listen to me. But it's, you know what I mean? Because it was
I needed that coaching, because I got the, like, if it was a bad game, he'd look at me, he'd look at his mom, and he'd be like, I'm riding with mom. Like, I'm not getting in the car. I don't want to get in the car with dad. I don't want to listen to that going down the road.
Yeah, man. Oh, good times. Good times. Oh, I love it. This has been so great. Last question. Success. How do you define success? What does that mean to you?
Oh, man, that's a good one. You know, I think the word success is tricky, right? Because the end goal mm-hmm. for everyone is so different, right? Like some people want to be CEOs. Some people want to travel the six countries this year. Some people want to retire by 40. So I think honestly, for success for me, I would say is probably, you know, I think success is defined as passionately pursuing to achieve your own defined goal, because I think it is so different depending on for every human. But I think success should be reaching the things you want to reach. And I think, you know, if you can do those things, if you can sit at the end of your career and say that you did those things, I think you're successful. But define your own goals would probably be the way I'd leave that. Don't let somebody else write them for you.
Love it. Awesome. Well, this was great, Brian. I'm so happy that you came on the program, and I knew this would be a great episode. You're a great guy. I'm really impressed with everything you've accomplished and the way you go about your business. So really appreciate you coming on. Come back again a little bit down the road. We'll catch up and see how things are progressing in this crazy world. But thanks again for being our guest, and we will catch you soon. And folks, thanks for tuning in today, and we will be back very soon with another episode. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.